Thank you for joining me as I discuss Resurrectionists, an episode dedicated to the morbid history of body snatching and the creation of body brokers. I'm Megan Brooks, and this is a walk through history. This episode contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. What do you want for your body when you die? Do you want to be buried in a nice plot, or do you want to be cremated? Maybe you want a green funeral and use the new composting companies that decompose your corpse and turn it into soil. Or maybe you want to donate your body to science to help future doctors and advanced medical research. Today, there are countless options for aftercare, and the one we will be focusing on today is donating your body to science. There are many reasons why someone would donate their body. Many people believe in the benefits of their anatomical gifts. For schools like the New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center, donated bodies are essential to their research. This medical center is using human samples to trace the evolution of diseases on a molecular level. With over 50,000 samples, their researchers can individualize medicine. With diseases like leukemia, there needs to be a constant supply of samples to study. The center relies on the ability to look at the way cancer is changing in a person. Researchers can use your bioinformatics to find exactly when treatment started working or why it's not. This is very important because a treatment for leukemia that works for one patient may not work for another. Researchers wouldn't know that unless there are samples to work with. Through their sample system, there is a well-kept set of rich data on clients and how they respond to treatments. But it harkens back to medical schools throughout all scientific history. A school needs samples to study, but bodies weren't able to be kept for long due to lack of cold storage. So a fresh body was needed when the previous corpse was far too gone to continue use. When the executions of criminals lessened, the regular source of corpses dwindled. So this, of course, led to grave robbing. Everyone is familiar with the case of Burke and Hare, and if you're not, you should look it up, even just for the freak factor. But besides them, the first registered case of grave robbing was documented in 1319. Four medical students in Bologna were asked to retrieve a fresh corpse to be reviewed in the study and teaching of anatomy. Public dissections, usually of condemned criminals, were the most common method of obtaining remains to study. So the necessary evil of hunting for the dead kicked up. These people became known as resurrectionists. Men, and sometimes women, were paid to dig up bodies from freshly laid graves and deliver the subject to a school. Most resurrectionists would work in teams, one member scouting the cemeteries or funerals, and however many it took to collect a person freshly buried. Most grave robbers picked mass graves for the poor, as they were most often left uncovered until filled with coffins. Paupers' graves were the most frequented. By the 1700s, grave robbing became so commonplace that cemeteries hired people to keep watch over those interred. This eventually gained the moniker, the graveyard shift. As you would expect, the 1832 Anatomy Act was passed in the UK, making snatching a criminal offense. Turns out that people don't like the idea of someone's body being taken and used for nefarious reasons. Like many schools, the prestigious Yale School of Medicine was also found participating in the raiding of dead bodies. Early morning of January 12, 1824, Jonathan Knight, Yale's first professor of anatomy and physiology, received startling news. During the night, a body had been snatched from a fresh grave in West Haven. Incensed townspeople were pointing fingers at the college. Some suspicion of students was justified. There was no legal way to obtain cadavers at the beginning of the 19th century, but like many places in America's youth, New Haven was founded on Puritan tradition that naturally fostered strong religious feelings. Yale historian Hannibal Hamlin wrote about the incident in 1935 for the Yale Journal of Biology. Their respect for the sanctity of the sepulcher bordered on superstition. The doctors were held with high esteem, but the dissection of a cadaver by the surgeon or anatomist was considered nefarious and unmentionable. When word got out about the robbery in West Haven, a search began for the missing corpse of Bathsheba Smith, the respectful young 19-year-old daughter of a local farmer. The West Haven borough constable, Erastus Osborne, was dispatched immediately to the college. Given that grave robbing was so prominent, everyone knew what had happened. They eventually found Bathsheba Smith in the medical school building at Grove and College Street. Osborne later stated, "We came to a place in the pavement, the cellar being paved with large flat stones, which looked generally like the bottom of the cellar throughout, but appeared to have a trifle of fresh dirt laying scattered about. I scratched with the end of my walking stick, and the more I examined, the more suspicion was created. We soon found the earth appeared fresher between the stones and finally took up large flat stone where we discovered a white bundle. We examined it and found a human body doubled up in a heap entirely covered up with graves clothes. We took it out and it was immediately known to be the body of a young woman we were searching for." The scandal stirred up such ferocious anger that a mob of 600 men armed with pistols, clubs, and daggers stormed the college at night. Though the police cited the state's riot act several times, the crowd kept pelting the building with stones, shouting, "Tear down the college," and "Death to the students." A medical student hunkered down in the building wrote a letter. At midnight, the governor's guards were called out. They assembled on the green. Each man was provided with a sword and bayoneted gun, with a ball and cartridge. They marched a quick step to the Med College, inspired by fire and drum, which beat the revel and sounded the notes of war. Ultimately, Ephraim Colborn, a Yale medical assistant, was found guilty of the crime and sentenced to 9 months in jail and a fine of $300. Hamlin argued Colborn may have unjustly taken the fall. He was the one person indicted, two suspected medical students having transferred their studies with great alacrity to other parts before they could be dragged into court, and the evidence against Colborn was circumstantial. There were no witnesses. While the New Haven dissection riots of 1824 were certainly a strange chapter in the history of the school, Yale is not alone. Despite epidemics of cholera, smallpox, and other diseases, the general public had little appreciation for the work of anatomists. There were more attacks on med schools like the New York Doctors Mob of 1788 and Westenthal's school in Baltimore. Because of this, Connecticut established more severe penalties for grave robbing and made it legal for the bodies of those dying in prison and those capitally punished to be used for the purpose of advancing medical science. This landmark legislation, well ahead of that in other states and preceding the Warburton Anatomy Act of 1837 in England by 8 years, helped bring about progress in medical teaching both at Yale and in Connecticut. Unlike days past, medical schools today get their bodies through willful donations. One such person is 65-year-old Peggy Riley. Riley defines herself as a world traveler and mom of 3 kids. She had a stroke in 2012 and is permanently disabled. When she explained to her son why she wanted to donate her body to a medical school, he had the same reaction most of us would. Why would you want to have your body poked and prodded, dissected, and shipped around the country? It's because funerals are too expensive. She would rather someone learn from her body and her remains be handled by the medical school or hospital than leave the family with the cost of funeral expenses. According to the National Funeral Directors Association, the median price is about $7,300, and cremation is only about $1,000 cheaper. The Federal Trade Commission shows that basic services include the funeral director and staff, pickup of the body, embalming, other preparations of the body, the casket, funeral memorial service, and graveside service, including staff and equipment, not to mention the hearse. It's a robbery, but so is the unfortunate story of other countless donated bodies today. There is an open case against surgeon Sam Kazemi, Arizona Biological Research Center, or ARBC, instructor to hundreds of medical students. His class includes How to Dismember a Corpse, a normal procedure medical students need to know. A video of his class was leaked showing pliers, scalpels, and motorized saws, the types that are meant for home repair, not medical saws used in hospitals for amputations. He explained that a good day's work includes breaking up 5 or 6 people to be sold later. An investigation into Kazemi's work shows several thousand remains waiting to be sold. ARBC was a non-tissue transplant bank run by body brokers, people who encouraged the dying to donate their anatomical gift and give future doctors the best education. For example, companies will specifically ask for a knee, a leg, a hip, or a shoulder. Some will even ask for arteries. Your torso is sold to the Midwestern healthcare system for $3,119. Your femoral arteries are then sold for $65 each, and your lower leg costs $350. It is the body broker's job to ensure collection of goods occurs and reaches the designated location. Reuters investigative news company wrote an expose in 2017 on Arizona body brokers exposing 2,280 other donations, invoices for thousands of harvested bodies, and records on how they were dissected and where they were sent. In reality, that's far more organized than other tissue repositories. ARBC's operation was raided at the Phoenix base, which consisted of 10 tons of frozen human remains. 1,755 parts total, consisting of 281 heads, 240 shoulders, 337 legs, and 97 spines. In 2015, the neighborhood around the suburban warehouse reported a foul smell and bloody boxes by dumpsters. Health inspectors were called to address the odor, and to their horror, found an employee thawing out a corpse in the Nevada midday sun. One inspector stated bits of tissue and blood were washing into the gutter. The inspectors learned that the employee was preparing the torso and other parts for sale. One donated individual the investigation exposed was Conrad Patrick, a 75-year-old factory worker with a ninth-grade education, who lived with his wife in a motorhome and died 6 days before the investigation, hoping that his body would teach someone to perform everyday medical procedures. He became number 1311, 2013. In Conrad's file, it showed that he was cut into seven pieces. His left foot was sold to Chicago and his left shoulder to LA. His spine to the US Army, external reproductive organs to the local uni, and his right foot to his knee were placed in a company's freezer, adding to the $1 million inventory of flesh and bone to be sold later. More than likely, Conrad was not informed through his consent form that while his body may be used by medical schools, dissected and shipped to various medical teaching or research facilities, there was no specification as to what research would be done. These consent forms also don't need to specify how long his remains would be held onto and used. Not surprisingly, an unnamed employee where Conrad was stored reported to Reuters that conditions were like meat packaging plants, and the government never came to regulate the location. Most people in this facility were too poor for their funeral, so they ended up in a human chop shop. To add fuel to the fire, it has recently been released that Harvard Medical School has been selling donated bodies and parts to the highest bidder. Like many medical schools, you could walk around the campus and never know that the clean new buildings housed corpses that were donated, getting ready for dissection, and then cremated. But the donors' families also didn't know that the now twisted dark corners of oddity collections had crept into the morgue. There are multiple indictments from June of 2023. Several people involved with the Harvard body selling have been accused of stealing parts from the medical school morgue. Between 2018 and 2023, Cedric Lodge, 55-year-old morgue manager of the Harvard Anatomical Gift Program, was accused of letting buyers come into the morgue to buy donated cadavers. Lodge was responsible for 400 stolen body parts and sold them from the morgue. In this case, six other people were indicted. Denise Lodge, Cedric's wife, Katrina McLean, Joshua Taylor, Matthew Lampe, Jeremy Pauly, the middleman here, and Candace Chapman Scott, another mortuary worker from Little Rock, Arkansas, who's only connected because of her purchasing selling of remains to Pauly through her program. Most of the people indicted are involved through Jeremy Pauly, through his access to the Lodge's morgue at Harvard supplied several oddity collectors. Katrina McLean, who owned Cat's Creepy Collections, bought human skin from Lodge and paid Pauly to tan human skin for her work. McLean also paid Lodge through Pauly $600 for two desecrated faces. In all of these gruesome collections, Pauly knew he was providing stolen human remains. To Joshua Taylor, who paid Pauly 39 times through PayPal for his human remains of the Harvard morgue totaling $37,000, two payments titled Head Number 7 and Brains. In 42 states, it is legal to sell human remains in brick-and-mortar stores. There is no federal law specifying saying selling human remains is illegal. As there is no federal law regarding human remains, the indicted are charged with conspiracy and interstate transport of stolen goods. Jeremy Pauley is facing up to 15 years in federal prison after he pled guilty to these charges. But as I was writing this, a ruling issued February 12th, Suffolk Superior Court Judge Kenneth Salinger upheld a consolidated motion to dismiss the suits, citing in part Massachusetts' 1971 Uniform Anatomical Gift Act and Qualified Immunity provision. This sounds sketchy to me, because the UAGA also prohibits trafficking in human organs to profit from donations for transplant or therapy. Salinger wrote that under the provision, if defendants acted in good faith to try to ensure human remains were treated with respect and properly disposed of when no longer needed for educational research purposes, they were immune from the suits. Are they saying that buying human skin and paying for it to be tanned by someone is medical research, or being respectful of the person's donation? Salinger still dismissed the claims because the factual allegations in the complaints do not plausibly suggest that these Harvard defendants failed to act in good faith in handling the donated bodies, or that they are legally responsible for Mr. Lodge's alleged misconduct. But that's what's so awful. It's not surprising that there's an underground network of people collecting human remains from their macabre hobby, but that it was happening at such a prestigious university. It is recognized that when a grieving son or daughter hands over their loved one to Harvard, they're trusting the storied institution to handle them with respect, passing over their parent or grandparent believing that they're in safe hands with the academy. Donations are special. In an apology letter from the University Provost Alan Garber and Dean George Daly, we owe it to our community and especially to our anatomical donors and their loved ones to ensure Harvard is worthy of those who, through selfless generosity, have chosen and will in the future choose to advance medical education and research. An anatomical donation is among the most altruistic acts and deserves our attention and profound respect. Individuals who make the donation are then cremated or buried in Tewksbury, Massachusetts, depending on the donor's wishes. Memorial services are held every year, with invites sent to donors' loved ones. For medical students, conceptual presentations and oral exams need to have physical work on the body to implement. There needs to be a tangible reality. The key to treating real people is practicing on real people. Students learning about spinal stenosis need to see how treatments with tibia bone transplants create spinal spacers, and that only happens through donated bodies. Looking at all the horrifying events throughout history and now at Harvard, it's understandable why someone would be less likely to donate their body to science. I wouldn't want my body being turned into a creepy doll or kept in a freezer for years before being used. But families need to know there are programs run with dignity. For example, Joe Watermore, president and CEO of Associated Medical School of New York, makes sure bodies donated in New York are legit. Tracking the donation, who and where it's from, and that they're sourced from reputable means. Jeffrey T. Lathman, Sr., the Director of Anatomy and Functional Morphology at Mount Sinai, ensures his students know each cadaver, that their first patient is treated with dignity and respect. Medical schools like New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center, which is individualizing medical care for cancer patients, use respectful storage methods. Keeping their samples frozen in liquid nitrogen, keeping their samples barcoded, and properly naming each part. The Institute of Human Anatomy, which has a wonderful educational YouTube channel, keeps their donors wrapped in sterile plastic with a cloth for added protection. Their storage room is kept clean and organized. Each individual donated is registered and given credit for their gift. And lastly, the Human Tissue Act of 2004 regulates the removal, storage, use, and disposal of relevant materials. But trusting these institutions to do the right thing by promoting the Consensual Donation and Research Integrity Act, or Body Broker Bill, will create a chain of custody for each human body or part. We as a society need to remember that if it weren't for the numerous stolen bodies historically, we wouldn't have skin grafts. If people hadn't donated their bodies, we wouldn't have transplants or hip, shoulder, or knee replacements. Our cancer researchers wouldn't have the supplies and samples they need to continue their advancement for finding cures. An in-depth understanding of anatomy is imperative for crucial medical skills that include a clinical history and examination, as well as clinical reasoning that would be required to make a correct diagnosis and the management of a patient. A sound knowledge of anatomy is essential for safe and effective medical practice. Cadaveric dissection has been the bedrock of gross anatomy teaching and learning for years and forms a vital part of medical education. That is why donating your body to science can really be amazing. And if you want to find out more information on it, please contact your local medical school. That does it for this episode of A Walk Through History. Thank you for listening.